Good afternoon. Can everyone hear me? Hello. My name is Lawrence Norman. I'm going to be moderating this panel on the EU's neighbourhood and the problems in its neighbourhood. Thanks, everyone, for being here. We are awaiting one last person on the panel, but he's going to arrive in a little bit, apparently. So we have here on my right, we have Giles Merritt. And Giles is a former journalist at the Financial Times. He is a very widely read commentator on defence and security issues. And he's also the founder of Friends of Europe. Next to him, we have Guntram Wolf. Hi. Guntram is the director of Bruegel, has been so since June of 2013. He's a former macroeconomic policy advisor at the European Commission and also once worked at the Bundesbank. And then we have Ambassador Mark Otter to my right, one of the most experienced diplomats in Brussels. He is currently Director General of the Egmont Institute for International Relations. He was a senior advisor at the Belgian Foreign Ministry. He was formerly the special representative of the EU in the Middle East peace process, and he was a defence advisor to Javier Solana. And to my left is Pierre Dufresne, who is executive director at Madariaga, a former cabinet head of Pascal Lamy at the Commission, and a lecturer in a number of places, including the College of Europe. And he set up, I believe, and directed the Brussels European branch of the French international relations think tank, IFRI. And then on my left is, on far left here, is Fabien Zulig, chief executive and chief economist at the European Policy Centre, a former economic analyst in the private and the public sector. And I think, Fabien, you have probably one of the rarer PhDs in Britain, a PhD on the political economy of European Union enlargement from Edinburgh University. I'm not sure how many British people hold such a distinguished academic degree. But anyway, that's everyone on the panel. Thanks very much for joining us. I am the Deputy Bureau Chief at the Wall Street Journal here in Brussels. I focus mainly on foreign policy and enlargement issues, and I can be found 400 times a day tweeting at Law Norman. So if anyone doesn't follow me, I hope you will by the end of the afternoon. The issue that we can list all the Twitter accounts at the end. We're hoping to finish at the very latest at 5:45 because I know Guntram has to leave at that point. The issue that the title that we've been given is The Neighbourhood in Shambles, Can the EU Fix It? I think probably most of the panellists will agree that it is in shambles. Before I turn it over to a couple of the panellists to give their opening thoughts, I just wanted to somewhat frame the discussion that we have. Perhaps there are a number of questions on the neighbourhood at the moment. The first one is Europe's approach to it, which is known as the neighbourhood policy, fundamentally broken? And if it is, how should it be fixed? I think there's even a question as to whether we should have a neighbourhood policy, one kind of overall architecture framing our relations with neighbours, or whether we should simply see them as a series of governments that we should treat differently. It would be interesting to hear the views of the panellists on whether they think the southern neighbourhood and the eastern neighbourhood should be equally important to the European Union. And clearly, I think we'll touch on, and it would be good to hear people's views on how the neighbourhood will be shaped by the conflicts with Russia over Ukraine in the east and the priority now within the bloc on issues like counter-terrorism and migration in the south. So I hope the panellists will touch on some of those issues If I can turn and start with some thoughts from Giles Merritt over on the right-hand side for about 3 to 4 minutes, and then I'm going to come in rigidly and wrestle control of this from him. Thanks a lot.
Okay. Well, how do I turn it on?
I think it's automatic.
Oh, it's automatic. Great. Couldn't agree more. Let's scrap the neighbourhood policy. First thing to be done. I was listening to Vice President Kaitanen and thinking, it's good stuff, but it sounds like business as usual. And frankly, our foreign policy looks like business as usual, despite the fact that everything's deteriorating very fast. So, first thing, let's get rid of the neighbourhood policy as such and publicly tear it up and say it didn't work. We're going to start afresh. Then I looked at the thing. Can the EU fix it? No, the EU itself can't fix anything. It's the member governments that possibly could fix things. And at the moment, they show no signs of doing so. But I think we really have to call a spade a spade. Europe's larger countries pursue historical foreign policies, which, naturally enough, as they were competing colonial powers, are competing foreign policies. So we must try and get the member governments, especially the big three, to own up to the fact that they are the problem, not the solution. Now, what is Mrs. Mogherini going to do? First thing, we need clear-cut analyses of where we stand on Syria, Russia, and Turkey. And those, I think, are the three key problems. That requires us, first of all, to admit that we mucked up the post-Arab Spring policy. We've actually made things worse. We've also been complicit in the Russia problem, in my opinion. I think we were very clumsy in the way we arranged a Ukrainian beauty contest between us and the Russians. So I think we've been really complicit in that, and we must stop doing it. We must stop digging the hole. So what that brings us to the European External Action Service, if Mr. Mogherini is going to do all this. The question is, does it speak with one voice or does it squeak with one voice? I think it's more in the squeaking league at the moment. And it's not surprising. All in all, there are less than 2,000 people engaged in EU-level diplomacy. Look at the member states. It's over 50,000. So again, the member states are the problem. We must try and get them to butter out. And at the same time, we must get the Action Service to really improve its act. It doesn't behave like a foreign ministry. It doesn't do scenario building. It doesn't have good reporting. So it has created, or it is the victim of, and is helping to continue to create a European foreign policy that is purely reactive. Purely reactive, and given the fact that we don't agree with each other, the reactions are not very coherent. I think I'm going to stop there. Excellent. And come back later with some other thoughts.
That was less than 3 minutes. Thank you. Can we turn it over to Fabien? I mean, do we need to tear up the European neighbourhood policy, Fabien? Have you already done so?
Thanks. Well, thank you for the kind introduction, firstly. I think despite my PhD, I'm not going to talk about enlargement, mainly for two reasons, because I don't think a significant enlargement is a realistic possibility in the near future, and also because of the power of attraction of enlargement has reduced quite significantly. So we need to deal with our group of neighbors and partners and sometimes challenging partners in the surrounding geography differently than maybe we have tried in the past. And there I would say clearly a one size fits all hasn't been working. It is not going to work. We're talking about a number of very different countries which have very different priorities in their relationship with the European Union, going from the non-EU Western European countries like Switzerland and Norway to Russia, of course, the Ukraine, Belarus, the Western Balkans, North Africa, the Middle East, very, very different relationships. And I think what we need to look at is finding the right kind of relationship for the individual country or for the small group of countries. I think for some of these, this is a form of differentiated integration, trying to bind them in on particular topics. Of course, for that, they will want to have that differentiated integration. So there must be a desire to integrate with the European Union. And also, I think maybe the even more difficult part is I think we then have to decide how we deal with differentiated integration within the existing EU and some of the trends we are seeing there. I think with the others, it is much more about issue-based relationships, trying to focus on particular areas of interest, energy, security, migration, economic development, and then try to find a constructive way of building a long-term relationship. And I'm not sure whether having an umbrella of a European neighborhood policy is actually helping us to do that. But in the end, I think I would also say I agree with Giles. This is still an area dominated by the member states. So there's always the big question of what do the member states want the EU to do? What will they allow the EU to do?
Thanks very much, Fabian. Can I ask Ambassador Otter, are the member states the problem? Are the member states the problem?
Well, I think one has to always be reminded of the nature of the common foreign policy of the EU. It's a common foreign policy. It's not a single foreign policy. So that has never been the objective. So when you speak about common foreign policy, it's like it's a symphonic orchestra. Every player knows his partition. But if you don't have a conductor, then you have a cacophony and not symphony. That has to be understood. And yes, it's the responsibility of the member states, because actually it's their will, political will to do something. But I think leadership is very important too. And we have to give some time to the new high representative to prove her capability to do that. I think in some areas she has already started. She will need time, and I would agree with Giles that one of the problems is that the instrument at her disposal is not very functional. I always say to colleagues that when you talk to external partners about EU foreign policy, stop showing the organogram of the EAS. So I think that's the first point. Now, do we need a neighbourhood policy? Of course we need a neighbourhood policy. Everybody has a policy with their neighbour. If you don't try to shape your neighbourhood will shape you. That's not the best option. And indeed, the European neighbourhood policy was created at some point in time the objective was to integrate our neighborhoods into a system that is stable instead of integrating their own instability. So the problem is that when you have a neighborhood policy, others have a neighborhood policy too. That's exactly the message that the Russians send to us. It says, okay, you talk that of Ukraine and Moldova and the Caucasus, your neighborhood is my neighborhood too. Lavrov made a very clear speech at the end of 2013 in Brussels about that, and said it was sent as a warning. You discuss that with us. So that's another consideration. And I would say when it it comes to, so if you need a neighborhood policy, it has to be adapted to the current times. The problem is that you have a systemic crisis in the South especially, but also in the East, within a broader systemic crisis, which is the end of the Cold War order, the post-Cold War order of cooperative security. That doesn't exist anymore. It's the return of geostrategy. So if we want to have a neighborhood policy and a foreign policy, it has to adapt to this new reality of that geostrategy is back.
How would you go about fixing the neighborhood policy if you believe it needs to be fixed? What would be your basic approach?
It's not the neighborhood policy that needs to be fixed, it's the EU. Remember Robert Cooper saying the enlargement is the greatest accomplishment of the EU foreign policy and the evidence that there is such a foreign policy. I always found that statement very odd. But behind the statement, there was the idea that the neighborhood was the promised land for EU external action. And now what do we see? The neighborhood policy is underground zero. And we're part of the problem. We actually, by our ambivalence, our hesitation, our lack of consistency over time, have created a mess with Turkey and the link with the Middle East, so that we don't know exactly whether Turkey is still a partner for us or not. And I'm not talking of Ukraine, which has become a place where America and Russia are sorting out the problem with Europe as an onlooker. In fact, we have succeeded in turning Europe as a junior partner on its own continent. And why is that? Because we cannot have a foreign policy. We might have something that is called an external action service, very nice, but that's not a foreign policy. A foreign policy is about of course, first and foremost, Weltanschauung. It's about common objective. It's about the instrument. The idea that we are a soft power is a joke. It's a delusion. There is no soft power without a hard power. That should be clear for everybody. Without common defense, there is no common foreign policy. And therefore, what we are doing is frankly playing like the Greek choir in a tragedy.
Guntram, there is no soft power without hard power.
Well, I mean, thanks. It's always a pleasure to talk after Pierre, my friend Pierre, because I very often concur with him. And let me contradict a bit what Giles said. I mean, I don't think the national authorities have been the problem. I think rather the European authorities have been the main problem in the way they have approached the initial contacts we've had with Ukraine on the trade side. This was just a disaster. We approached the free trade agreement with Ukraine as if we were doing a free trade agreement with Panama, and I think that's just a reflection of the absence of deep and long-standing historical knowledge that exists in the city. So to my mind, the European institutions have pretty much failed in this. Now, it has become a bit better on the sanctions side. We have had a unified sanction front, which means that we have been able to actually define a common stance, at least in the economic area, towards Russia. Now, you can debate to what extent sanctions will do their job that they are supposed to do, but what you cannot debate is that we have had a unified front, and we will see how this will continue in the next weeks with the new Greek government. But for sure, for now, we have a unified front, and in that sense, I think at the moment, at least on the economic front, we have a pretty good policy. Now, since you mentioned no soft power without hard power. Let me certainly, since my 3 minutes are coming to an end already, let me certainly throw the idea in the ring, asking, well, where do we stand actually in terms of our defense capabilities, also at the national level? European army, let's put that aside, but at the national level, is now the moment to actually use the resources that we have. And in fact, I think we have the potential at the moment to borrow at a very inexpensive rate. Isn't now the moment to really rethink military budgets and so on, and be a much more credible player externally by having a stronger internal, by having stronger hard power in place in case it is needed? And I hope, of course, it's never going to be needed, but I think the signal is quite important, and the signal we are giving at the moment is quite a weak signal towards Russia.
The charges that we have messed up our policy towards Turkey, we have messed up our policy towards Ukraine. Ambassador, do you think that's fair?
Well, I don't think we should sort of beating our chest all the time saying it's our fault. I mean, Turkey's policy is Turkey's responsibility, and I think the way the Turkish, by the way, that also a neighborhood policy, Turkey, which says no problems with no problems anywhere. Now they have all the problems everywhere. And they are certainly internally, domestically, Turkey is not going in the good direction, and it's becoming less and less of a reliable partner because of what is happening inside, concerning the freedom of the media, concerning repression of those who oppose the political vision of the president and the prime minister. So, yes, we have a certain responsibility in mismanaging maybe over the long term the relations with Turkey, but the present position of Turkey is the responsibility of Turkey. They have been... to a large extent, a negative factor in the way things have developed in Syria and in Iraq. Whatever the responsibility of the Europeans for their weakness and so on, I mean, other players are not waiting for Europe to be strong or to be weak to have their own strategic ambitions. And as I said, the system has changed. We have to put in our minds that the way international relations will be conducted in the next decade or so will be different from what it has been after the end of the Cold War.
Charles, let me turn it over to you. Have we mismanaged our Turkey relationship? And particularly, I want to go back to your first point. Have we mismanaged it because of the different interests of member states?
I'm going to do what politicians do, say it's a very interesting question, but before I answer it, I want to say, I'm not a diplomat, so I don't understand the difference between a common policy and a single policy. What I do understand is that we're seen around the world as divided on key issues. And what I also see is that we haven't thought through what our policies are in a whole range of areas. Go from security to global governance. We don't have a plan. And I think we really need to think seriously about this. Now, we can criticize the Americans for clumsiness, but they have a foreign policy community in Washington, D.C., that tends to think things through. I don't see the same thing in Brussels. So when we talk about, the sanctions have worked, who is thinking, well, do we actually want a bankrupted Russia? How dangerous would that be? And we never really thought through the post-Arab Spring situation and said, right, we can give them some money, which, of course, we never did. But above all, these guys don't speak to each other. We need a security framework. We never did that. We never sat down because we are mentally lazy. We stick to our tracks of the last 50 years, and it's time we woke up.
Charles, sorry, let me take you back to the question. Turkey. Where is the evidence that it's the different views of member states that are the problem with Turkey, as opposed to what the ambassador said, that Turkey is the problem with Turkey?
Well, the problem with Turkey, of course, was Paris and Berlin. Those two big countries didn't want Turks in the EU. The British did, but for rather ignoble reasons. So I think the Turkish problem begins in the capitals, but it's not exclusively that. I think we, again, going back to running on our rails, the EU saw Turkey as an economic issue. Most people see it as a geopolitical problem. But no, we conducted the accession discussions, still going on after 10 years getting nowhere, as if it were an economic problem. And I think we're reaping the consequences.
Gunther.
I mean, just on the last point, I would emphasize not Berlin and Paris, I would emphasize really your last point. I mean, the issue in Turkey is that even now we talk with Turkey like the schoolmaster to a student, and that's just simply unacceptable. I mean, Turkey has become a very significant and important player geopolitically, in terms of our relation to the entire region there, in terms of even our economic relations. Mm-hmm. We cannot consider Turkey as member state number 29. It's not member state number 29. It's a very serious player with which we have to do a very, very serious discussion, and not one schoolmaster versus student. That's not going to work. It's failing, and therefore I think our neighborhood policy that has been centered around accession has been a failure for Turkey, clearly. And I think it's time to change. We need to come to a mature relationship with Turkey.
Let me just ask the panelists very briefly. Does anyone here think Turkey will ever be a member of the European Union?
Yes, I do.
You do? Okay. I think you might be alone on that, Charles. Is that on this
you
panel?
You didn't ask me when.
I'd like to turn to Pierre. When, by the way? Giles, when?
When, about 2040.
Okay, thanks. Pierre, the couple of people have mentioned the Arab Spring. Let's talk a little bit about the southern neighbourhood. To what extent does the EU have any ability to influence events to the south? In the aftermath of the Arab Spring, during the Syria conflict with Iranian influence growing. Do we have any influence there at all?
Very limited one. First, we have our traditional competition among our member states for market share and investment status in several countries of the region, and that matters much more for them than any strategic vision. And with regard to the overall deal between the Arab world and the West, we remain within the Quincy Pact framework, that is cheap oil for security of the dynasty and the regimes, that is against the people. So the very reason why today we are in such difficult position vis-à-vis the public opinion in most Arab countries and partly with our own Muslim community is because, for those very reasons, we have been supporting the status quo, which means denying the mass in the Arab world prosperity, fairness, and democratic liberties, which we are preaching as our main values and something we would like to spread all over the world. And I think that terrible contradiction must be overcome. It's a difficult strategic choice. It's a long-term vision we have to develop, but if we are to bring cohesion within the EU, we have to address this question.
Pierre, let me hear you follow up a little bit on that. I mean, I'm sure we could all talk about this for about 5 hours, but in 2 or 3 minutes, how do we begin to make that policy less incoherent. How do we begin to do that?
By building up our own political unity. It is impossible for 28 countries as a loose coalition with three so-called big three, who are not big anymore but who think they still are, and one is on the verge to leave, and some new member states who are activists by definition. It's impossible if we don't have a foreign policy with majority decision, with common defense within NATO. We cannot play a significant role in a huge strategic issue as that one. We'll always be forced to stick to the American line, which is fine for America, but might not be exactly ideal for us, since we have more Muslims on board than they have at home. They have the Jews, we have the Muslims.
Fabien, you're the king of the differentiated approach. How do we apply that differentiated approach to the southern neighborhood to get better results than we're getting?
Well, I think the point I made before is very important, that we're not necessarily talking about something where we can say one size fits all. There are different interests there. I think there are some economic interests we can build on. But I think we also have to get used to understanding a bit more the give and take nature of the relationship we have to have. We cannot expect that the neighboring countries will simply accept a closer relationship with the European Union without some form of concessions which they see is in their interest. So when we're talking about energy, for example, how can we make sure that not only are we improving our energy security, but we are actually helping some of the countries to build up their own energy security, to build up their own capability in those areas. When we're talking about trade, we need to actually see what impact trade is having on these countries and whether it's a positive impact, and how and what kind of distributional consequences this actually has in the countries. So I think it's that differentiated approach by theme, by interest area, and also by the type of partner which we are facing. Some of those will not have an interest in particular relationships with the European Union. And certainly I think the number of ones which see enlargement as the ultimate goal, which they will make concessions to the EU, has become very small indeed.
But Fabien, I mean, one of the criticisms of the EU is that after the Arab Spring, as Giles mentioned, money, I mean, it talked about trade and aid, etc., to those who reformed, and yet it's a slow process. It takes ages to approve a trade pact. It takes ages to shift the budgets. I mean, is that part of the problem here, that we're not rapid enough in rewarding those who make progress and disciplining those who don't?
Well, I think speed certainly helps, but I don't think it's the only answer. And I think in some areas we have talked about closer relationship, but when it then comes to areas where it's politically difficult for the European Union, we shy away from it. And I think we can see that very clearly in the way we've dealt with immigration from these countries. That is, of course, a key interest for these countries themselves, but I'm not seeing that is embedded in some kind of coherent framework where we're working constructively with these countries, where they also get something out of that relationship.
Ambassador, you dealt for years with the Middle East peace process. Federica Mogherini wants to be involved in it. She took her first foreign trip to Israel and the area. Does the EU have anything to bring to the Middle East peace process? Is it able to really offer anything to the parties to end this conflict?
Certainly, but I what I think is necessary is a shift in the thinking and in the strategy. We speak always about the two-state solutions. Now, that has been going on from 1993 with a certain methodology When you apply a medicine to a patient for more than 20 years and that the patient is not cured, the problem is with the cure and not with the patient. And I think, yes, Mrs. Mogherini has been showing her interest for the Middle East peace process. She intends to appoint a new special representative. Good luck to him or to her. I've been through this long enough.
You don't want to do it again?
No, thank you. but I think it's also need to take it, if you talk about the Arab, which is it's not an Israeli-Palestinian, it's an Israeli-Arab conflict. And in the present time, and I've made some trips recently to the region, that is the last item on their agenda at the moment. The only strategic advantage that some Arabs are looking for is to say, since that what they would like is to make their strategic alliance with Israel more evident and more visible, is that they would need a gesture on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict to make it possible vis-à-vis their public opinion, who are still very much opposed to rapprochement with Israel. And that should be part of the objectives and of the approach. It should be that the general context in the Middle East has changed, that therefore the dynamics of the Israeli-Palestinian or the Israeli-Arab conflict have changed also. So I don't have any magic formula, as you know, and nobody has. But sometimes one should learn from their mistakes.
And Ambassador, to take you back to the original question, I mean, what should the EU be doing better? Could it be doing better in the southern neighbourhood as a whole?
Well, first of all, what you have is chaos. You cannot manage chaos very easily. So I agree with my colleagues on the panel that one of the responses is more EU coherence, more EU unity, that more integration of their policies, that's no doubt about it, but that's valid for any other strategic issue. So what we need is strategic patience. And certainly the formulas that were talked about cannot apply at the moment. You know, the three M's, mobility, money, markets, it cannot work. Now, maybe you can do that with Tunisia, because Tunisia has done a successful transition, but not with the rest of the countries that are interested, especially the bigger country, interested about in strategic dominance of the Gulf and the Middle East. So how do you want to convince Europeans that they have to encourage migration from the region to Europe? I mean, it's not going to work. Simply, that's why you need strategic patience and think about long-term, a decade before you can see the fog of war dissipate in this particular region. So is there nothing to do right now? Yes, there is, but it should be in a crisis management mode and doing the sort of thing that are possible now in order to avoid outcomes that you don't want, while at the same time planning for a longer-term strategy that would be more structural. I think it's Giles that mentioned the idea of a regional economic order. I think the Middle East needs a regional security system. Yeah. The Middle East countries, I mean, if you look at defense spending around the world, 7 out of the top 10 are in the Middle East. The countries of the region spend 3 times as much as Europeans on defense. And therefore, this is because there is a feeling of insecurity. That is one thing. The other thing is, in thinking longer term, we should be less Eurocentric. We have a certain number of values or political projects. The countries of the regions don't necessarily have that. So ownership is the first slogan if you want to change policies in the long term. And as far as Europeans are concerned, is to better understand the social dynamics of these societies, because they've applied formula that will never work because they did take that into account. When it comes to defense, I agree with what colleagues have said about the need for the Europeans to be more capable. Now, Pierre, I doubt very much that it could happen within the framework of NATO, because of the Americans have shown clearly that they are not interested to intervene in that region anymore. And therefore, building more European capabilities, yes, but as my neighbor said, you need money, and this is not the way it's going. Actually, Europe is the only place in the world where actually defense spending is decreasing. Now, the military budget of China represents the sum of the German, British, and French defense budget combined this year. That should tell us the magnitude of the effort that needs to be done.
Let me float a question out there to anyone on the panel. We all know the budget situation is bad in a lot of member states. Given what's happened with Russia and given the mess in the Middle East and North Africa, does anyone believe that if the financial situation were better, that member states would be really spending more and would be prepared to pool that money, Guntram?
Well, I mean, let me just, since I brought this point up, let me just make a point. I mean, I think Germany is under providing security. I mean, I'm not myself a military expert, but everything you hear is that compared to other countries, certainly compared to the UK, it's under providing security. Yet budgetary issues, I don't really see them. So the Bund can actually borrow at negative interest rates, 0.3% at a 10-year horizon. So it seems to me that the budgetary side shouldn't be the problem for this. I mean, so I certainly think that's something we should be thinking about.
Charles, is money the problem or is it political will?
Well, actually, the whole thing is a farce, isn't it? The reality is that we have about 2 million people in uniform. Only 2% can actually be given a gun and told to go somewhere. And most of the money, more than half, goes on salaries. So the whole thing is a bit of a joke. I'd like to come back to this question of values. I just heard it used for the second time. In the business world, they say that hope isn't a plan. Well, I think values isn't a policy. We talk about values as if it had some sort of intrinsic worth in political terms. And we used to talk about soft power in the same way. And soft power is actually just enlargement. We need to start, as I said before, giving ourselves the mental exercise of deciding what we want, what are our concrete interests, and how can we get consensus before crises break, not after. And I think everybody here knows, we all know the inner workings of the EU. We all know that in terms of foreign policy, co-repair and then the council deal in chicken feed. The real big issues are not looked at in advance, and to a very large extent, that is the fault of the EU. And I hope that Mrs. Mogherini will pick up on what Mr. Kaitanen was saying earlier. He obviously has a taste for naming and shaming, and so should she.
Pierre, do you want to respond to that? I mean, you're what you said about the Middle East was in a sense to match our values with our actions. It seemed almost the other way around. I mean, do you think the problem that we have with our neighbours is partly because we have too much emphasis on values?
I never used the word values. Too easy. I look facts. With regard to defence, clearly, the very fact that defence budgets are being cut is an opportunity for streamlining and making a common defense easier. It's not, so it goes in the right direction. It's an opportunity. And once you have a common defense within or outside NATO, it's a very important distinction. I up still for within NATO, it's time to think of your objectives. But first, try to get the objectives, the instruments right. I believe that's the key point. And frankly, something which strikes me as a citizen here in Europe is how we're able to live in a sort of schizophrenia between our economic integration and that lack of integration with regard to our foreign policy, especially because the fact our defense is split between national government and NATO without a real European dimension. I think that consistency prevents to create in Europe a sense of commonality of destiny. That's the real issue, and then we can talk about values.
So Pierre, you said it's an opportunity that the defence budgets are going down. It should encourage It should encourage greater pooling. Why isn't it happening? Yes.
Because I think we're going through a sort of leadership lethargy in Europe. Europe is unable today, with the type of leadership we have, with focus on national issues, to have the inner force to initiate something really new, something really important. We can only expect events from forcing us to respond to challenges, but we are unable to think ahead of what should be done for Europe. And people realize that. People realize that there is a political vacuum at the top of Europe today. It's an institutional, but it's also an anthropological problem. And the question is, since Evans will never be missing in the future, first one is actually Tsipras' victory Sunday in Greece. That forces us to bring back on the forefront of the debate the question of the governance deficit of the Eurozone.
Fabien, Russia. How will the events in Ukraine shape Europe's policy in the East? To what extent does it mean that our new neighbourhood policy is to gather as many friends as we can and keep them safe from Russia?
I think that in the end we are going to face a significant challenge, and that is going to maintain the unity which we've had within the European Union up to now. By and large, at least, we've had unity. So the question for me is, how will this look going forward? Are we going to be in a position of strength vis-a-vis Russia? And that, I think, mainly depends on what we do internally rather than whether we gather friends along the way or who is going to be on what side in that discussion. And that, I think, is a very significant question. To some extent, it is surprising that we have managed to keep the degree of unity we have had. But as long as the situation is unresolved, I think there's going to be continuous pressure, and certainly Russia is going to try to see how they can drive a wedge between the European Union countries. So it's the economic weakness of Russia. It will certainly have an impact, but at the same time, if we have the political fragmentation, which we're not only seeing in the foreign policy field, if that continues to influence the European Union, then I think at some point in time we will have a significant split in the member states, which will mean that in the end our policy with Russia is going to be totally ineffective.
Charles, do you see a complete divide coming in the European Union at some stage on sanctions and the approach to Russia, or do you think they can hold it together?
I mean, who knows is frankly the answer to that. But what strikes me about our conversation so far is that we're sticking with today's crises, and we should be thinking about tomorrow's crises. we don't seem to have given any thought at all to what sort of security stance we should have in the Far East. We don't have a China policy, just as we never had a Russia policy, and we certainly never had a policy for the Middle East. We just went in and out as the Americans told us. You could say we were yanked around. What I think we really do need to be looking at is your bicycle's fine, it's just thunder. What I think we really do need to be looking at is what sort of policies should we be adopting now to help shape a better world? Global governance. What sort of deal should we cut with the BRICS? Security. What sort of responsibility do we have for Africa? We all know there's a great long list of things, and we're not looking at them. And I think it would be more productive to worry about those than to the probably rather insoluble questions at the top of the agenda at the moment.
But, Ambassador, did you want to come in?
Well, I think what Jack said is absolutely fundamental. We're taking care of urgent things, Islamic State and Russia, but the important thing is China. We have to organize the 21st century world order in a way that we can accommodate China as a full member of the international community through, hopefully, a peaceful rise. And we, as the EU, are co-responsible of the peaceful rise of China. We have to think ahead on this very crucial matter, which is yet much more important than anything we deal with today.
Ambassador, are we spending too much time worrying about Russia in the aftermath of Crimea, and should we be thinking and dealing with other things?
Well, I think, first of all, when it comes to Russia, and following what I said about a new sort of world or system of international relations as it's taking shape, we should look at to see whether we can work with Russia on things where we agree. Russia can be helpful, and is helpful, is Iran. There's been a very constructive partner in the dialogue on the negotiations on the Iranian nuclear potential. We can deal with Russians when it comes to Islamic fundamentalism or Islamism, because we are under the same threat by the same people. We could have dealt better with Russia when it came to Syria before the Ukraine crisis, because we made the mistake to... We should have flown the high representative or whoever was in charge to Moscow, not to Arab capitals. And I know by my own contacts with the Russians that they were prepared to be positive, as long as we recognize that they have their own interests in the Mediterranean and in the Middle East. So that's one thing. But what was the other question?
Well, the question was, should we not be focusing so much on Russia's actions in Ukraine, and should we not be focusing our foreign policy attention right now on responding to that?
Well, we cannot ignore it. But there again, you need strategic patience, not to rush through short-term solutions. We need to look at that at the long term. If re-engage in a dialogue means again saying, I have interest, you have interest. You need Europe to rebuild your economy, your infrastructure. We don't need Russia for energy. Russia needs us for energy. And I think it's very important. That's why you need to look at the recomposition of the strategic landscape. You know what I've heard in Tehran? Come on, we can solve your Russia problem when it comes to natural gas. Work with us. So I think it's
it's important, and yes, that's the main challenge in what several panelists said, is about how do you put in the EU a system of strategic thinking where you look not only at the current crisis, but where you have a sort of 360-degree view of the situations as they develop in the world, and use the assets of several the richness of our member states, who have, you know, more knowledge of about some regions in the world, to put that together and to give then somebody who is in charge the strategic direction. I think, in my view, and I was there at the foundation, that was the original idea of having a high representative. That has not been exploited always to the fullest, not only because of the system, of the institutional system of the EU, or because of the personality of the high representative, but because of the pusillanimity of member states when it comes to defending their interests together.
Guntram, you listed sanctions as one of the things that we've been actually able to do. Do you think that we focused too much on sanctioning Russia, and we should have been more looking for opportunities to find common interests, or do you think that would have been the wrong approach?
Well, let me make 2 points. I mean, one is on China, and I'm sorry, I want to bring it back because it is an important topic. I absolutely think it's absolutely crucial to have China in a well-organized world order, and Europe should play a role in this. And that is, I think, one reason why I always had some doubts about TTIP. I mean, TTIP, of course, has a lot of benefits, but it was also very much perceived in China as a signal, the West against China. And I mean, I think we need to work very hard on overcoming this impression, and maybe a wrong impression, but certainly, I would very much welcome initiatives that try to increase growth, increase trade, increase investment between China and the EU. I think it would be a very important signal for us to peacefully engage with China and get China as a peaceful, it is already a very peaceful player in global politics, but integrated even more. Now, on the sanctions as such, I mean, I have to say what I said is we have a common ground. We have a common front on sanctions. But I didn't say that necessarily those sanctions will deliver super beneficial results, and especially not, they may not yield the results that we wish to see. And I'm just pointing that the literature, and that's just a question of a rudimentary reading of the literature, but the literature seems to suggest that sanctions do not always achieve what they are supposed to achieve, be it North Korea, be it Iran, where, frankly, I don't think you can call the sanctions a success. You can say in South Africa they have been a success, and in the 80s and have indeed changed the regime. But overall, I think there's quite a mixed evidence on the effects of sanctions. Now then there comes a big question, what else to do, and you know how to shape it further. But certainly. I would hope that our leaders that decide on the sanctions have some intelligence, ideally from Moscow, and know what kind of political dynamics are being triggered by those sanctions. I don't know it myself because I'm not in Moscow, but I hope that our foreign services know that this is actually having a beneficial effect on the debate in Russia.
Fabian, let me turn it over to you. Until the Vilnius summit, we had an Eastern Partnership policy with approach to 6 countries. 3 of them walked away from it. Ukraine is in the middle of a civil war. Georgia and Moldova are very much under considerable Russian pressure. We don't know how that will end up. Has Russia torn up our Eastern strategy? Do we have an Eastern strategy still?
I'm not sure that I would have classified that as a strategy. I think we had something which noted to some extent what kind of relationships we wanted with these countries. But I think what we are seeing is that there was also a lot of wishful thinking there, that in the end we were hoping that these countries would want to ally with the West, and that the Russian pressure, which was undoubtedly going to come, wouldn't lead to them to rethink their strategies. I think this is clearly a situation where we need to rethink a number of these strategic issues in our neighborhood and beyond. And I think this is something where there's a lot of agreement on the panel. I think the big question in the background here is, yes, we all agree we need to be more strategic, but how likely is that going to be? And I think when we're looking at some of the internal developments within the European Union, where we can't agree on some quite fundamental issues in areas such as economic and monetary union, where through mutual interdependence we're actually forced to find some kind of agreement, I think the chance that we are going to be a strategic actor in some of these other areas where we can avoid some of the conflict and where we can avoid hitting the national vested interest, which is clearly there, I think basically the tendency will be to try to avoid conflict. And I think what we are going to see is what we are also seeing internally, a continuous wish to muddle through, to react to whatever is happening with very little long-term strategic thinking.
I'm going to turn it over to the audience in a sec. I just want to ask the panel, each of them, to name one thing that they think Federica Mogherini has done well since she came in. It can be on the neighbourhood or anything else. And one thing that they think she's handled badly. And 30 seconds maximum on each. Giles.
I think she was right on Russia. However, what I think we really need is a cultural rethink. Our problem is that Brussels thinks in terms of dossiers. It doesn't have the big picture. And until we start to fix that, we're going to be stuck with a whole lot of intergovernmental squabbling.
Well, I think the big challenge she has to solve is really to bring together the different policy areas that we have. I mean, cannot think trade policy separate from foreign policy. We cannot think defense policy separate from foreign policy, and so on. And I think that's her daunting challenge. And frankly, I think it will be a very big challenge.
I'm sorry, Gunjan. That was an interesting answer. It wasn't an answer to my question. One thing she's done well. One thing she's done badly.
So both. One thing she did well, and one thing she didn't do well. You're asking too much of me. I have to think about it a bit.
Okay, one thing she did well then, go on, will be nice.
Well, I mean, I think she so far on the sanctions, I think she's been doing a good job.
Okay. Ambassador?
I think she did something in the symbolic area that is part of the idea that she be vice president of the Commission, also is to install her offices in the Berlaymont instead of the EES. I knew Pierre would agree. I don't think she has done something bad, but I think she probably lacks experience, but she seems to be learning fast.
You've already ticked off your positive, Pierre. Do you want to give us another one?
For me, I think she has the right sensitivity on the Russian issue, but that should not make her shy away from strong sanction. You can at the same time like, understand Russia, and be tough with sanction when needed.
Fabien?
Last in line is always difficult, but I think she has talked to many people and has engaged in some debates, which I think is quite a positive change. I think what hasn't happened so far is really bringing the new cluster structure into reality and having a unified foreign policy which involves all the different elements. But then I would say that's not necessarily down to her, because I think making that cluster work is going to be exceedingly difficult for anybody.
As a journalist, clearly the best thing she's done is she's not frightened of the media, which is none of you mentioned, and she actually can talk to journalists, which is a miracle. And she's tweeting. She's in communication, very true. Right, over to the audience. It's okay to make statements, but if you're going to do them really, really, really briefly. But generally, we like questions, and I will quote Federica Mogherini: if you ask three questions, the panelists can pick which one they want to answer. The gentleman in the second row back with the tie, yeah.
Good evening, Simeon Konakchiev, Maastricht University. So I have a very short question. Do you think the failure of the neighborhood policy has something to do with the peachy status of our energy security and migration issues right now? We failed to export our policies properly to the neighborhood, so now we don't have secure energy sources, and we have a lot of people that want to leave our neighborhood and come to Europe. Thank you.
Guntram, do you want to take that one?
Well, I mean, on the energy side, it seems to me that this is really a very positive agenda we have been opening up here in the city, which is the agenda of the energy union. And I think it has, it came unsurprisingly from Poland and from the current president and former prime minister of Poland, Donald Tusk. I think that's a very good avenue. It is, as an economist speaking, it's a good avenue for the EU countries as such, because it will make, if it works, and that's a big if, yeah, but I mean, if we achieve something, if we achieve a single energy market, we can substantially reduce costs for energy, and we can reduce our dependency of individual countries on gas imports. So I think it's basically, from a European point of view, a no-brainer. Now, will we achieve it? I mean, that's a much more complicated question. We will host Vice President Shevkovich tomorrow at Bruegel and discuss with him energy union. Let's see what he will say and how far we will go. Certainly, as so often in these fights, there's a lot of resistance from particular interests, be it specific energy companies, be it specific countries, and so on. So I do think it's a positive agenda, and I think it's a positive agenda that will also help us in our relations to the neighborhood.
Does anyone else on the panel want to weigh in on that in particular, on whether we can achieve an energy union any more than we can achieve a common foreign policy? Sorry, just on the panel. Is there anyone? No? On to the next question then. Sorry, Fabian, go.
I was just about to say, I think the first thing we really need to see is what is meant by energy union, and I think that's one of the big questions on the table. If we're talking about truly an energy union, which we would understand as a single unified market, then I think it would bring all the benefits which Guntram has just mentioned. I fear what we're talking about is an expansion of interconnectors, which mm-hmm. will have very little effect in the long run. So we shall see what the energy union really means. But of course, the more ambitious you get, the more you get into the political debates, which are entirely unresolved. And I think when we're looking at some of the agenda points of the new commission, we have to say we've been there before. They've been on the agenda before, and we failed to achieve them. So I'm not sure we're going to do much better.
Giles, very quickly.
Very quickly. Could I just say that I think the external dimension of energy is really very secondary. The fact is that we have got no new power stations under construction at the moment, and we've got a deep problem on the structure of the energy market, and that's where you've got to start.
Thank you. Next question, someone from the back. There's a gentleman right at the back on the far right-hand side. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Can you say who you are? And yeah.
My name is Mohammed Rajai Barakat. Mr. Ott, don't you think that neighborhood policy failed, such as Euro-Mediterranean cooperation, because the European Union tried to integrate economically Israel before trying to find a solution to the Israeli-Arab conflict? Mr. Jamlit, you said that we have to change our policy against Arab countries. What kind of policy you suggest? Mr. Pierre Dufresne, you said that we have to influence the Arab Spring. Why? What can we do? What we have to do with them? why we don't let them do their evolution alone. We accompanied them and we failed. And at last question about soft policy, soft power and hard power. We tried, even if European Union has a very big and important army, what can it do in Arab countries and with the Arab Spring? European Union was well seen when it was a soft power, and when it associated itself with the hard power, USA, and went to Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, and all these countries, it failed with its policies in the Arab countries. Thank you.
Thanks. Ambassador, do you want to weigh in on any of those questions?
If there is any failure of the European neighbourhood policy, it has nothing to do with integrating Israel in the Mediterranean dialogue. It actually was a success of the European Union. It was the only time that Arab countries accepted to sit down at the same table as Israel, and there was a real dialogue. So it's not a failure, it's a success.
Anyone else on the panel on any of those others? Giles?
Yeah, what can we do? We can start putting our money where our mouth is. I remember talking a few years ago to the Tunisian central bank governor, who kept on ringing up Brussels to find out where the promised money was. Well, apparently the cheque was in the post, but he told me it never arrived. I think we really did mess up in the post-Arab Spring thing. We didn't have a proper thought-out plan. We didn't have a privatization strategy for them, despite the fact that the ex-communist countries were the great experts on that. And above all, we didn't create a security framework, and it's not too late to do so.
Pierre, I think you ought to come in.
The real benefit of strong power is to make soft power more effective.
I just want to take the Arab Spring point that Giles made and a little bit the questioner made. I mean, we weren't prepared for the Arab Spring. Was anyone prepared for the Arab Spring? Was the Middle East prepared for it? Were the Americans? Did we handle it, Fabian, any better or worse than anyone else?
I think certainly no one foresee what was going to happen. So I think in terms of preparation, but the question is also at what kind of response do you then put into place when it happens? And I think there was a lot of wait and see. There was a lot of uncertainty about what kind of regimes would be supported, and certainly delays in coming in on the side of some of the more democratic forces. So I think the response didn't give a very reassuring message to those countries. And clearly when you then had some of the re-revolutions, some of the anti-democratic forces gaining power, again, I think Europe was caught a little bit behind the curve. But I think to some extent, we are talking about a very highly volatile, uncertain situation, and clearly we can see that in the responses of all the international players, it was very difficult to know what exactly to do at that point.
Thanks. I'm going to bring Alastair also back in. You wanted to...
Yeah, I think about what we could do. Did anybody respond better? I don't think so, but I think... What we failed to see is that we knew what was the problem. We've known it for years. If you read the UNDP Arab Human Development Report, it's all in there. And I remember that that's one thing we knew. We knew we were sitting on a volcano. The only thing we didn't know is when the volcano would erupt and what would be the trigger. For that you can be excused, but not for not knowing what was happening. And what I heard a lot about this, and including our policies vis-à-vis the region, when I was traveling in the region, is that when you met with civil societies, that the problem with you is you don't do what you say you will do. And therefore, you have seen us maintaining the status quo.
I set a bad precedent by... That was four questions, and you actually got four answers. So can we have one, or at the most two questions, from the gentleman there in the middle, yep. Yes, sorry. Apologies, Hugh. Could you say who you are and where you're from, please? Thanks.
Yeah, hello. My name is Michael Olson. I'm with Eurosavant.com. And I'm going to test your policy, or the gray areas of your policy, with two questions or challenges to the... And in particular, the first one to Ambassador Otte, who mentioned in his initial remarks about the end of collective security, which in this context one has to think means NATO. I'm a Dutch national, not a Polish or Lithuanian or Estonian or Latvian national, but allow me, if I may, on part of them, in light of Vladimir Putin's new policy to advance the interest of his co-cultural and co-linguist linguists in the Sudeten, in the Russian-speaking areas, in light of the fact that the Lithuanian Defense Ministry recently issued a manual to all citizens on what to do and how to behave in the event of a Russian invasion. In light of the fact that I think it was Vice President Biden who visited Tallinn on a reassurance visit a few months ago, and of course in light of Article 5 of the NATO Treaty, if there's something that Ambassador Otte knows that these citizens don't know but they need to know, if he could let us know, we surely can pass on the message. And my second challenge is to something that Mr. Wolf said, where he was complaining about the headmaster-student relationship when it came to Turkey. And I agree, that's maybe not entirely accurate. Turkey's not a student. Maybe Turkey is more of a petitioner that wants something that we have the power to give it. If I might take the position of the Polish people again, that proud republic of 39 million, they got, for them it was, hey buddy, here's the acquis communautaire, take it or leave it. The question is not about whether you'll take it or not. The question is the details about how you will. So in other words, I would say that the Turkey was a petitioner, not really a student, but a petitioner, and why shouldn't it have been otherwise, given that all the other countries that came in 2004, et cetera, got the same treatment? Thank you very much.
Thanks. Gunchen, do you want to respond to that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think the point I'm making is that defining the relation with a country like Turkey in terms of membership relation is not the right approach anymore. I mean, so I agree with you, of course, if they want to join, then there is an acquis that they have to accept. I don't think we can put it on the same. I mean, I think there is much more scope for negotiation for a country like Turkey than for a country like Bulgaria. That has to be done. But certainly by now, I think the framework of membership, EU membership, is not the right framework, and it has been a break on our relation instead of actually a promoter of our relations.
I'd like to ask that to the panel, because it's an important question. It's one that may well come up in the next few years, given the way EU-Turkey relations are. Does anyone else think it's time to say, look, the accession process is dead? Obviously, Giles, you don't. You're waiting for 2040. And it's time to focus the relationship through a different framework. Pierre or Fabien, do you want to weigh in on that?
As far as I'm concerned, I've always been convinced that Turkey has a homework to carry out. It has to bring together its nation. It has to develop the underdeveloped part of Turkey. And as long as they don't do that, you cannot have a serious partnership with Turkey. It's a domestic problem. And they've tried to skip it by joining the EU too early. That's the real issue. And now they're confronted with the reality, and I think they might be confronting it seriously.
Fabien, do you agree? And if so, what kind of, you know, how should we frame the EU-Turkey relationship if you do away with the accession process?
I think we should be careful about removing the accession process completely out of the equation. I think in reality, yes, no one is expecting that this will happen in the near future. But there is also the question what kind of signal we are giving to particular groups within Turkey, and particularly those groups which have committed over decades to the accession process, which have seen this as a crucial part of trying to influence the development within Turkey in the right direction. I think the message we could be giving to those groups is extremely negative. So I think, yes, we have to be realistic. We have to say that we are not going to achieve membership in the near future. Maybe 2040 is a realistic target. But I think to completely remove it out of the equation after also a lot of political capital has been spent on trying to achieve at least some of the way in this direction, I think would be the wrong signal to those groups in Turkey which we really want to support.
Charles, you want to weigh in?
Yeah, I just want to say, of course, the problem with journalists is that they like headlines. So Lawrence asked one, I gave him one. But the reality is we must stop thinking about membership because Turkey's much too big for that. It's the big regional power. And think Ottoman. So therefore we have to find new relationship with Turkey, new mechanisms which can accommodate them, and they're a rather different form of democracy to ours, but at the same time keep them inside the tent.
Next question. Come on, there's got to be more out there. Come on, wake up, folks. Yes, I know. Gentlemen, in the second row there, blue tie.
Hello, thank you. Živko Želazko from Maastricht University. My question is about NATO. Does NATO and the EU have increasingly conflicting policies? How should we define our relationship with NATO? Isn't that the basic stone for a common foreign policy as well?
Giles, I'll start with you.
I'd just like to say very briefly, thanks to President Putin, the EU and NATO are now on the same page.
Ambassador.
Well, I go back to the previous questions about Turkey. If we don't sort out our relation with Turkey in a way that was explained maybe more creatively, you won't have a fundamental EU-NATO agreement to work together. And that's still a problem because we don't want to create another NATO among Europeans just to avoid the Turkish problem, but that is central.
Let me maybe slightly morph off that question. I mean, most of you on the panel were somewhat critical of our approach to Russia or felt that we should be seeking out common ground and thinking ahead a little bit more. I mean, is one of the reasons that we've gone for the sanctions policy because the US is so influential and because NATO is so influential in Eastern Europe? Does anyone think that that's part of what you consider to be the problem, Pierre?
Well, it's obvious that in this whole strategy of enlargement in the neighborhood, the Americans and some faithful allies within the EU have been using those countries as potential partners for controlling the development in Europe. It's clear that this strategy existed. And now the question is to bring back those countries in a common strategic concept which is of genuine European nature, and this is the reason why personally I'm pleading for a common defense within NATO, to make the difference between a loose direction which is mainly thought through from Washington, or something which reflects the reality of political integration in Europe.
But Pierre, let me ask you. I mean, if NATO weren't parked in Europe, would Russia have gobbled up most of Ukraine already?
You know, first, and then we go back to square one, which is the condition in which we have created, in a very, I think, dangerous way, a feeling of fear and insecurity in Russia far beyond what was needed. I think that is the original sin of the West in Russia. It's during the Yeltsin year. And I think we're paying, in fact, the price for that extremely condescending, arrogant, and in a way a very shallow strategic approach of the transition in Russia. The cost is now.
Does anyone want to weigh in on that? That's a pretty controversial ambassador.
I agree with what Pierre said, and it was a conscious American strategy from the beginning. To me, the main reason for creating the OSCE was to push the Russians out of the former Soviet area of influence. The same thing in the Balkans. And I think that's why the Russians are getting even, and they're getting even not only in Ukraine, they're getting even in Europe. They're using what they call their soft power to chip away at the European cohesion. In the Orthodox world, look at the trip of Putin in Serbia. They're looking there in discussion with Greeks and Cypriots about a naval base in the Mediterranean, and they're financing populist parties in Europe. So that's what I wanted to do.
Does anyone disagree with that on the panel? Does anyone disagree with in the audience? Anyone want to stand up and say, gentleman over there, yeah, with the green tie? Sir?
You?
Yep.
With the green tie.
Okay, thank you.
Can you tell us who you are and who you work for?
My name is Andriy Bystritsky.
No, from... Sorry, it's the gentleman right at the front.
Sorry.
We'll come to you after. Can you press the button?
Can't hear you.
No. Try again.
Okay.
Great.
My name is Joost van Eersel of the European Economic and Social Committee, and this last point was longer on my mind when Mr. Wolf started right in the beginning countering the argument of Mr. Merritt that the fault was primarily with the European Union instead of the member states. And then I would like to put the next question to him and to the panel. When the explosion in Lithuania took place and Putin refused, all member states leaders were there to ratify. And 2 hours before, Putin said no. Everybody was astounded. Now, I was very astounded, I must say, when I heard 2 days later the president of the Federal Republic saying, well, we have made an enormous mistake. We didn't include Russia into the negotiations about the future of Ukraine. Now, Germany is the only country in Western Europe that has a ministry for Eastern Europe. It has traditional, deep relations with Russia. It understands its spirit, as it is said. And my question is, what is, by heaven, the reason that the ministries of foreign affairs, in particular in Germany, had not a clue of what was going on? And have they learned anything?
Thanks. The role of Germany, Guntram.
No, I mean, I think I raised exactly that question. This is still incomprehensible, and I think it's incomprehensible. I think it's a gigantic failure, and I think we will have to see what history books will write about it. I mean, I honestly don't know the answer to your question, but I think it's an absolutely central question that you're asking.
Can I,
but have they learned anything?
I don't know.
Let's broaden it out to the rest of the panel. Does anyone want to weigh in on this in particular, or even on the other point that Guntram made earlier, which is, you know, Germany's kind of light footprint within the EU and how much of a problem that is, Giles?
Only to say we were talking earlier about Turkey and what is called tutelage. Well, tutelage is something the Russians talk about a lot. and say, you know, we're a great big country, we stretch around the world, and we're treated like children. And I think there's a lot in it. I think we were very insensitive, not just with the sort of we won the Cold War stuff, but I think we were very insensitive about the importance of Russia, about its geopolitical weight in the world. And I think we still are. I think we don't know enough about the Russians. They're difficult to deal with, and they're unsympathetic at times. But ignorance is our fault.
Okay, we've had... sorry, go on, Fabian. Yep.
I just wanted to come in because it, to me, I mean, of course... I fully agree with my fellow panelists that the EU or individual member states have made many mistakes in the relationship with Russia. But I think it's still important to recognize that fundamentally we are talking about something Russia has done, which is simply unacceptable. And I think whatever else might have prompted it, I think we really have to be very strong on... there might have been different paths of getting where we got to, but in the end, once Russia chose the route it did, chose the military power, it put itself into a particular corner, which I think the European Union cannot accept. And I would also say, even if the European Union had done everything right, do we truly believe Russia would have done something differently? Do we truly believe that Russia is only doing this because we made mistakes in dealing with them? I think there's a much more longer-term strategic agenda from Russia which would have been carried out regardless of what the European Union would have done.
Okay, we have an all-male panel, and every single question has been from a man so far. Can we please do something about that? The lady in the third row, yeah.
So we are now dating. My name is Maya Fuchs from SWP. We are now dealing with the Russia-Ukraine conflict. So my question would be, what is the more important player for it? Is it the EU or the NATO? Because what we were saying earlier is that Russia is nervous, and they are more nervous about the EU than of NATO, I think. It might be because the Treaty of Association with a lot of countries close to Russia, and it might be because... some countries close to Russia got into NATO. So,
anyone want to take that? Fabian?
I mean, I think what we're seeing is very different roles. NATO clearly, I mean, the question is there a military solution in the Ukraine at the moment? I think that's, from the outside, it's very difficult to see how you could play a role which would be constructive there. So in that particular conflict at the moment, it's mainly on the economic side. And then on the economic side, clearly the EU is by far more an important player than NATO. I think if we're looking at some other places around Europe, if we're looking at the fears in the Baltic states, clearly I think there is the question of the NATO guarantee and how we can make sure that message clearly arrives on the Russian side.
Who else? There's someone right at the back on the left-hand side who I think has had their hand up for a while, yes. But I can't see you very well from here. Is that human? Yeah, the ladies at the back, right over there on the left-hand side. Do you have a microphone?
Can you hear me? Yes.
Yep.
My name is Irina Poulangica. I am from Confrontation Europe, and I would like to point out that everybody seemed to agree on the fact that the fault laid with the European Union and the member states in dealing with Russia, when we talked about being patronizing about Turkey, don't you think that the same could apply to Russia? Why should the European Union consult Russia about what a country which was an independent state like Ukraine wanted to make as an option? And this means that we do accept that Russia should patronize independent states, and as a consequence, because it couldn't be listened when it would have said no, they entered in Crimea. So I don't think it's a very good way of understanding Russia if we decided that they have the same mentality as the European Union member states, and that we can discuss with the Russian regime the same way as we would discuss with, Norway.
So, sorry, just is it fair to kind of frame that question as, in a sense, did the EU pay too much attention to Russia over Ukraine? Is that what your question is?
No, I think that the question is reversed. I don't think we should ask ourselves where were we, the ones who were to blame. And we never heard here the panel or the audience who was to blame about the way Ukraine was treated.
Okay. Anyone want to weigh in on that one, Guntram?
I think we all agree here on this panel that the invasion of the Crimea was unacceptable. And so certainly I think all of us would probably agree that also the policies in eastern Ukraine are completely unacceptable that Russia is implementing. So I mean I don't want to patronize on the others, but certainly I would argue this is unacceptable. Now I guess the question we are asking is could all of these things have been prevented if we had had a different approach? Mm-hmm. And then you can say, well, I mean, this country, Ukraine, has a right to just negotiate with us like any other country. But, I mean, there's risks to this, and I think that's what we are seeing. And, you know, then I guess there's a difficult moment there where I guess realpolitik meets values, no? I mean, which I guess went there. I'm not sure we did the line right, but I mean, but I see Pierre also wants to intervene, and I'm sure that Pierre is much more experienced in these issues, so let me see what he would.
But I think that Turkey and Ukraine, two large countries, should be treated as bridge countries. They should not belong to EU, they should not belong to another partner. They are intersections of two sets. And they are of common strategic interest for Russia and for EU. And therefore, it's not a question of being patronizing and so on. It's a matter of common interest and discussing this ahead. And by the way, not only ahead, now we have to do that with Ukraine, Russia, and EU, and hopefully an independent and united Ukraine.
The lady with the... there within the about season. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Yana Brovdi. I'm from the Ukrainian think tank's liaison office in Brussels. So you might imagine that I was quite upset to hear what was said during by all of you in this distinguished panel, saying that basically EU inflicted a fear on Putin. Fabian was trying to bring us in a little bit another argument. Thank you for that. From my point of view, all the EU and especially the EU member states have been doing in the past 25 years is actually trying to strengthen the economic ties with Russia, investing in Russia, cooperating with Russia, doing everything possible to enable something like French, in a way, German, what happened with French in Germany after the Second World War. And it has been a policy also of Germany for many years. They've been saying that if we cooperate, increase our interdependency, then there won't be any possibility for the war or any kind of conflict with Russia. So taking this in mind, don't you think that the real reason actually why things happened the way they did in eastern Ukraine is not because EU was inflicting some kind of fear on Putin, but because Russia developed inside, not in a proper way? It is not a democracy. And no one from you here mentioned this. And this is a very important point because If Russia were to develop as a democratic country, none of this would have happened.
So you have to look inside
Russia and not keep on blaming EU as much as you do here in during this event.
Let's take that as the final question for the panel. Is the real problem here not all the EU's dysfunctionality, but the way Russia has developed and its own ambitions, Giles?
Well, it's a pity that in Ukraine you put your money at one point on the unattractive Mr. Yanukovych. Didn't help. I think that you can argue the morality of all this till the cows come home. The reality, though, is we are where we are. And to say that it is unacceptable that what Russian policy is doesn't necessarily mean that we're in a position to reject it. So we're stuck with it. And I think that the really important point about all this is that Russian policy for the last 20 years, after the fall of the USSR, was to get back into the international economic system. They've blown it. It'll take 4 or 5 years for it really to start to hurt. But I think our only policy option is to sit it out, try and contain violence and tensions, and wait for the Russian people to realize that they've backed the wrong horse.
Final word, Ambassador. Is Putin going to fall in 5 years' time and resolve all our problems?
I don't think so. I mean, anyway, that's not what you should bet on. You should bet exactly what Giles said. It's about engagement. There are, I would agree, first of all, with the last question about the fact that we should stop bashing the EU all the time and being responsible for all the ills of the world. That's the first thing. The second thing is that yes, Russia is not entirely, not really a democracy the way we understand it, but there are still very strong democratic elements in Russian society. That's what we should do and encourage. At the same time, international relations is about reality. It's not about dreams. So we need to engage Russia, as I said, where we can engage Russia without being compromising on Ukraine or the behavior that they have internally or in other places.
Great. Thanks, everyone. Gunchen's got to go. Thank you very, very much to the panelists. Thanks to the audience. Have a good evening.